Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Colored Red. Before I get started today, I want to say a little something about the Golden State Killer arrest. Michelle McNamara blew this case wide open with her book, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, and she's one of my original inspirations and was one of my favorite true crime bloggers. I only wish that she was alive to see him arrested. Patton Oswalt also did an amazing job making sure her work wasn't left behind, and I'm so happy that the victims might find some kind of resolution in this. Some theories were bounced around that the East Area Rapist original Night Stalker could have been a suspect in the murders of the Bennett family, which I covered in episode 2. And if anything else comes to light about this that I think I could add to this case that hasn't really been said by any other podcaster, I'll definitely do an episode on it. But with all that said, we'll get on to the case that I have for you guys today, which is incredible. The information that I have has largely been gathered from this wonderful book called Shadow on the Mountain by Stephen Singular and Joyce Singular. If you hear this case and want to know more details about the emotions, politics, and unique societal circumstances that saw this case ending the way that it did, or if you're just curious about a different perspective on the history of Aspen before it became kind of an elite cesspool, please pick this book up. It's great. The case that I'm going to be going over today is much more recent than the cases I have done so far, having occurred February of 2014. This has quickly become one of my favorite all-time cases, not only for the twists and turns it takes, but for what it reveals about a town that a lot of people in Colorado feel is off-limits due to the wealth and elitism that the town is all about. I've always taken special interest in cases that seem to reveal a darker side of society's upper class and most respected people. So with that said, I present the murder of Aspen's golden girl, Nancy Pfister. Late in the day of February 26, 2014, Kathy Carpenter, a longtime friend of Nancy Pfister's, would go to Nancy's home in an attempt to locate her and talk with her. Pfister had come to rely on Kathy in the past years to help her with errands and tasks, and it wasn't because she couldn't do them herself. Some saw Kathy's relationship with Pfister as more than that of an assistant, as she was always in charge of her affairs when Pfister was away, and she was in charge of taking care of her house when Pfister was on trips. That evening in February, Kathy entered the dark home to the strong smell of dog mess all over the house, a window that was left wide open, and Pfister's dog Gabe without any food or water. Gabe was a young labradoodle who was largely untrained and needed constant attention, so him being left alone was odd. There is even a story that Gabe had once gone on a rampage in the house of Jack Nicholson and ended up in his hot tub, much to Jack Nicholson's dismay. And Kathy knew that Pfister would likely not have left for any length of time without getting someone to take care of Gabe. Kathy made her way upstairs and first noticed that the bed was neatly made, something that Nancy Pfister would never have done. Kathy then pulled the comforter back and noticed that there were no sheets on the bed. She went towards a special closet in the room where Nancy stored some of her more prized possessions and found it locked and the key was usually inside the handle, and that was missing. She then called her mother as well as a friend of Pfister's named Patty Stranahan and told them both that the home felt weird. She then put the dog into her car and went down to her condo to retrieve a spare key for the closet, feeling that something was inside of it and that she needed it opened. She got the key and came back into the home, heading right up to the closet. She opened it. A strong odor hit her, and on the floor was a sheet-wrapped bundle that she recognized as a body immediately. She ran out of the room and the house and promptly called 911 while she was racing in her car down the mountain. And I'll play a part of that 911 call for you now.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God.
911, what is the address of the emergency?
Help me. Oh my God. Oh.
What is the address of the emergency?
He came in and he was fucking Mouse Road.
Is that a house business or apartment?
It's a house. It's Nancy Pfister's house. My friend.
Ma'am, tell me exactly what happened.
Oh, okay. My friend had it. I got my friend in the closet.
Ma'am, tell me exactly what happened.
my friend came back from Australia, Sandy Sister, and she had some people living there, and she really pissed them off, and she made threats to them about owing money, and I don't know what I couldn't find her. She didn't call, and these people said the dog had been in the house and she hasn't been around. So I went up there to get the dog and was looking for her.
I need you to tell me exactly what happened.
I can't. My friend is in her closet. Yes.
In her closet?
Yes.
Okay, stay on the line with me. We're going to send help that way.
So she's clearly incredibly frantic, barely audible. She mentioned some people who she thinks that Pfister was in a argument with. And there's a little bit more to the call, but we'll go over that later. Kathy later goes on to say that she saw blood all over Nancy, even though Nancy was completely wrapped in sheets. It's also in some reports that Kathy said she saw blood on the forehead, but she meant headboard. However, upon hearing the call, it was clear that she did say headboard, and the transcriber heard it wrong and wrote forehead instead. There was visible blood seen on the headboard of the bed in the room, which is what Kathy was referring to. Kathy's strange answers and left out details would create a larger problem in the case later on. So shortly after the 911 call, police entered the home to see Nancy Pfister's body in the closet. She was wrapped in a towel, and there were garbage bags wrapped around the body in layers. There was an extension cord around her neck. Officer Brad Gibson, who was first to see the body, immediately surmised that they were looking for at least two assailants, because he surmised that two people would be needed to drag Pfister's body into the closet. Additionally, Gibson found a container of Force Flex trash bags, similar to those wrapped around the body, leaning against a garage outside. And at this point, and possibly the only redeeming moment for the Pitkin County Sheriff's Department, they called the Colorado Bureau of Investigation to assist them in the investigation. Kathy, who had made the call, was taken to the hospital for anxiety treatment for hysteria, then taken to the courthouse for questioning. Kathy told the same story that she had told while they were at the house, but she left out one important detail. At the house, when she was questioned, she indicated that earlier she had seen Pfister's two winter renters coming down from the home as she was going up to check on the dog, but now she was saying that she didn't see them. The two renters were Nancy Styler and her husband William Styler, and Kathy told police that they had been having a heated dispute with Pfister over the past few months over rental payments. Nancy Styler and William Styler had gone into town to stay at the Aspinall Lodge after moving the last of their things from Pfister's home, and had just completed moving as Kathy drove up the road to find the body of Pfister. Word was put out to find Nancy and William Styler, and they were found inside the Aspinall Lodge and were taken in without issue. At this point, details began to emerge about who Nancy Pfister, Nancy Styler, William Styler, and Kathy Carpenter truly were. I'm going to go through the different players in this story first, largely to give an indication of the pressure cooker that created the murder and offer some kind of motive or basic explanation for the actions that were taken. This murder case has as much to do with the history of Aspen and its reputation as it has to do with the suspects themselves. Nancy Pfister was born in Idaho on the 4th of July, 1956, the middle child of three girls, Suzanne, Nancy, and Christina. Nancy immediately set herself apart from her sisters by being the most outspoken and a bit of a tomboy. Friends would later recall that Nancy didn't wear makeup or keep her hair very well kept, and she had an attitude that she was rich and didn't need to clean up. In 1954, before Nancy's birth, Art Pfister, Nancy's father, bought the Lazy Chair Ranch for $30,000 and the Buttermilk Ski Area. Art wore a large white cowboy hat as sort of a trademark, and he was known for his water witching, which was an ability to locate pools of water beneath the earth, a talent that Nancy also supposedly had. Betty Pfister, Nancy's mother, was a Women in Air Force service pilot and was later inducted into the Colorado Aviation Hall of Fame. Art passed away in 2007 and Betty passed away in 2011. They were said to be good at everything they did except parenting, which they didn't take much action in. When they died, the estate came under the control of a law firm called Garfield and Hecht, and money was given out to the sisters on a monthly basis and only for approved transactions. According to a family friend, the three sisters couldn't buy a roll of toilet paper without getting Andy Hecht's permission first. Garfield and Hecht held the papers for Nancy's house and gave her a monthly allowance of $7,000, which Nancy considered to be too little. Despite this, Nancy managed to squander most of her money on frivolities and partying. She was known as a party girl who had spent much of the 70s and 80s partying in Aspen, doing copious amounts of drugs with any celebrities or nobodies who came through the ski resorts, and becoming a fixture in local bars. She's rumored to have dated Jack Nicholson and Michael Douglas and spent time hanging out with Hunter S. Thompson at his Aspen property. It should be noted that despite Nancy's entitled upbringing, she wasn't entirely without compassion and wasn't entirely wasteful with her money either, helping to build schools in Nepal and educating a boy from India in Aspen after flying him out there. She participated in a number of philanthropy projects around the globe, not really dedicating herself to any one of them in particular. She never made an attempt to develop a career. After getting pregnant by an ex-polo player named Ashley Kent Carruthers, Nancy gave birth to her daughter Juliana in Aspen, and Nancy and Goldie Hawn had their baby showers together. To give an indication of the wealth in Aspen at that time, the planet had about 1,600 billionaires, and 50 of them owned property in Aspen, their collective worth topping $335 billion. Aspen was started with the opening of a ski resort and later hosted the World Ski Championships in 1950. Later, the Aspen Institute was started, dedicated to fostering enlightened leadership and appreciation of timeless values and ideas and open-minded dialogue about contemporary issues. The Institute would go on to have connections all over the globe, and Aspen would begin to host musicians and artists. Art Pfister, Nancy Pfister's father, would then start Buttermilk in Aspen Highlands ski areas. Nancy Pfister was born into the age of endless party made possible by the hard work and wealth of the previous generation. For two decades or more, cocaine, weed, and champagne flowed at wild parties where celebrities and local ski bums partied side by side and made Aspen into a number one party destination. Even the law enforcement of the town had its hand in the party years, and everyone knew everyone. Nancy Pfister was longtime friends with the former sheriff, Bob Broaddus, as well as friends with the sheriff at the time of her murder, Joe DeSalvo. Aspen features a long history of law enforcement and the wealthy elite of the town running into curious predicaments that somehow ended up working out for everyone. The Pitkin County Jail, the only one for the county of Pitkin, also known as Aspen, normally housed around 500 people a year, and 80% of those people were in for drug charges. There's also a history of the DEA going under the radar of the sheriff at times to do drug busts because the sheriff is usually so close with everyone, and he had a unique way of dealing with drugs and crime when it came to his friends. The Pitkin County Sheriff's Office just didn't do homicides, according to the former sheriff, Bob Broaddus. So the case of Nancy Pfister's murder quickly became a mess in the sheriff's office, despite the involvement of the CBI. So Sheriff DeSalvo, the sheriff at the time of Nancy's murder, would immediately begin to share intimate details of the case with former Sheriff Bob Broaddus, who was especially torn up over the death of his close friend Nancy Pfister. The Styler's son hired a private investigator to work on behalf of his parents named David Olmsted, and Olmsted would uncover just how deep the entangled relationships of Aspen went. Gossip immediately took hold, and most people assumed that Pfister's drinking and drugging lifestyle had finally caught up with her. Others, however, thought Pfister might have finally crossed someone enough to enrage them. For all of Nancy's fun and intrigue, many in Aspen would say that those years were far behind her. Even Sheriff DeSalvo's most recent interaction with Pfister before her death was not a fun memory. In this recent interaction, Nancy had stumbled onto the stage where he was giving a speech at an event. She was carrying a shopping bag and wearing a big hat over her unkempt hair. It was obvious that she was very drunk. She kept saying, "That's great, Joe," and "That's brilliant," while remaining on stage as if awaiting her own reception. This event would turn out to be only one among many such bizarre and outlandish acts perpetuated over the years by Pfister. Unlike Nancy Pfister, her so-called assistant, Kathy Carpenter, was not Aspen royalty. She had lived in various other Colorado towns and filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy in 1999. She was an alcoholic going through AA and worked as a bank teller. In 2006, police had come to Kathy Carpenter's home after Kathy and her son got into a fight over his drinking. Like many of the people working for the service industry in Aspen, she could only afford to live there when given a housing stipend. Kathy met Nancy Pfister when Nancy came into the bank and Pfister began seeking her out personally as her teller. Eventually, Pfister told Kathy that she wanted her to become her personal assistant. Pfister began inviting Kathy to parties around town and didn't wait in letting her new friend know that she had entertained the Kennedys, the Dalai Lama, and any touring musician or name of interest that came through, presumably to make her interest in Kathy feel all the more special. Pfister eventually told Kathy to come to her house that she could teach her how to eat and lose weight, typical of Nancy Pfister, who had no filter around a lot of people and believed she was important enough to say anything, especially to someone she considered to be below her. Eventually, Kathy did come around to the house, but began to run errands for Pfister for free and drinking at the same level that Pfister did. Pfister didn't pay Kathy for much and continued her longstanding history of being cheap with supposed friends, often ordering the most expensive items on the menu at restaurants when out with others and then leaving the restaurant without chipping in any money. Despite the issues, Nancy Pfister and Kathy became close friends, or at least as close as one could get to the daughter of Aspen royalty. They became drinking buddies, but their friendship would soon see a number of problems stemming from Nancy's entitlement and drinking problems. In 2009, police were called to Nancy's home at 11:20 p.m. after she accused Kathy of trying to break into her bedroom, and she said that Kathy was having a mental breakdown. At this time, Kathy Carpenter told police that Pfister had been using her, and the officers escorted Kathy to the station where she could sleep off her drinking. In 2010, police were called to Pfister's home after Kathy had taken a handful of pills and was wandering around the house while Pfister was there. In February of 2011, police found Kathy drunk in a snowbank, and in November of that same year, Kathy was found on the ground in Aspen, curled up, drunk, sleeping under a white picket fence. Nancy Pfister would spend much of her last several years in Aspen thoroughly angering many of her close friends and fighting endlessly with tenants that she would rent her home to. In 2012, she had a dispute with a renter who was growing pot in her home, and when Nancy tried to sue the renter for missing valuables and pot supposedly left around the house, the renter countersued Nancy Pfister for trying to raise the rent from $3,500 a month to $6,000 a month on a whim. The renter was later shoved by Pfister, and the renter sued for the rotator cuff strain that she experienced. In August of 2012, Pfister entered a local Hampton Inn and told the clerk to dial 911 because she had forgotten where she parked her car, and she and Kathy had gotten into a drunken brawl outside of the hotel after a night with two men that didn't go to plan. When cops did arrive, the two women had found the car, and Nancy was in the driver's seat and was given a DUI, at which point she was taken into custody and the car was impounded. Afterwards, Kathy paid for Pfister to get out of jail, but Pfister also insisted that Carpenter had to pay her attorney fees for her DUI. They eventually agreed to split the fees, but not until after Pfister threatened to put an ad in the local paper denouncing Kathy, a bargaining tactic that she had pulled with people before. There was a couple who had just moved to Aspen, Teresa Wyatt and Daniel Trim, and they were with Pfister and Kathy in Pfister's home, and Pfister had her feet resting in Kathy's lap. When Daniel noticed Kathy had a bleeding finger and asked her about it, she said that he didn't want to know, a response that he never forgot. At one point when Teresa, Kathy, and Pfister were sitting on the couch waiting for Ellen to come on, Pfister learned that all the wine was gone and got into a tiff with Kathy, demanding that she go down to the liquor store for more. Pfister also had a habit of giving guests tea laced with marijuana and telling people not to talk during her shows. She was always very demanding, and until someone crossed her, and then the carefree side of her completely disappeared. Her and Kathy enjoyed an intimate relationship that Kathy insists was not sexual, with Kathy sometimes putting Pfister to bed and napping with her. After the death of Nancy's mother, Betty Pfister, in 2011, the reality of her poor finances and complete lack of control over them became more apparent. Nancy Pfister had bitterly said to Teresa that now she was an orphan, and Teresa remembered that it seemed like an odd thing for a woman in her 50s to say. Despite constant boasting about her money before the death of her mother, she would resort to renting her home out and staying with friends when traveling. So in 2012, Pfister stayed with Teresa and Teresa's parents in the Virgin Islands. Pfister told Teresa to carry her bags, and Pfister would wander around their private living areas, flirting with Teresa's husband. Teresa set Pfister up with a local real estate broker, who was driven crazy for 3 days by her demands and then eventual reveal that she didn't have any money to buy property in the Virgin Islands. Eventually, Teresa kicked Nancy out of the guest house, and Nancy wasted no time finding a strange man to live with on the island. After the charade in the Virgin Islands, issues blew over, and back in Aspen, Teresa convinced a producer to use Nancy as a guide in a travel show about Aspen. When the show was over, they took a copy of the DVD to watch with Pfister. When it didn't work in her DVD player, she threw a fit and exclaimed that everyone was out for her money because she didn't want to buy another copy for $6, despite the fact that Teresa and Daniel had to buy their own copy too. Later, Nancy would give Daniel a ride from downtown and insist they go to lunch, where she would stick him with the cost of an expensive bottle of Chardonnay and a plate of pasta she said she couldn't pay for, and he paid for not to make a scene. Later, they just avoided her when seeing her out in public. In October of 2013, Nancy Styler and William Styler arrived in Aspen to try to start their life anew. William Styler, or Dr. Styler, or as he will now be referred to from here on out, Trey Styler, was a prominent Denver physician before his slow fall from grace. Nancy Styler, his wife, was an accomplished surgical nurse, and the two of them met while working in medicine. Following a recent series of events that led them to sell their home and start their life anew, which I'll get into, Nancy Styler took over for the family as the leading breadwinner and entered into the Aspen scene out of the blue, applying to work at a local salon, doing esthetician work and beauty procedures. She was immediately noticed by the locals of Aspen, largely because she was considered very outgoing, brash, and slightly tacky. The employer at the salon she briefly worked at immediately noted that she was loud with customers, aggressive, and constantly bragging about her skills in cosmetics and Botox, as well as sewing, jewelry making, and upholstery. Despite her claims, Nancy Styler had never worked in the beauty or salon business, and it took her weeks to install all of her equipment into the salon. It was noticed that she was able to lift and carry all the heavy equipment in by herself without the help of her husband, an observation that would hold more meaning in the case of Nancy Pfister's death. So while in Aspen, the couple wanted to rent out a home and start to meet locals and get a foothold on their cosmetics business. The home they found was Nancy Pfister's. Their original arrangement was that they would stay in her house through the winter while Pfister went on vacation in Australia. And the arrangement was that they would take care of her house as well as her dog, Gabe, who, like I said, was a handful. While the Stylers were visiting with Pfister, the dog chewed up one of Trey's cameras and Nancy Styler's phone. The Stylers were once a prominent Denver family, owning a large home in Greenwood Village at one point. Trey was a prominent anesthesiologist and was once chief of anesthesiology at St. Joseph's Hospital. The Stylers met while Trey was practicing medicine, and he always seemed to have money, largely due to oil money in his family. Trey had been the valedictorian of his medical school class and was regarded as one of the brightest residents by other physicians as well as Nancy Styler, who worked with him. Nancy was flamboyant and loud, and she became a renowned horticulturist and one of the leading experts in the country on lily ponds. She had been featured on HGTV, and they had an elaborate lily pond garden in their backyard of the Greenwood Village home. Nancy Style attracted attention. Their house was decorated very gaudily, with pink furniture, lavender carpet, huge bouquets, massive chairs, and fake rock fountains. They held large parties where Nancy Styler was the center of attention. Her husband was much more reserved and seemed to be her opposite in terms of personality. Some even regarded him as not an attractive man and the yin to Nancy Styler's yang. But the couple persisted while their success started to falter. Nancy Styler was diagnosed with breast cancer and had a double mastectomy. Later, Trey was digging a new lily pond in his yard when a backhoe fell on his leg and he was seriously injured and never fully recovered. At this point, he claimed he was too injured to continue practicing medicine, a move that some colleagues thought was an easy cop-out that many physicians try to resort to. Trey gave up his medical practice. At this time, to try to make money, Trey offered his services to a company to design a new system that connects patients to physicians. He put off this work and kept giving them excuses and an arrogant attitude, and he was eventually fired for never producing the new system that he promised. In 2003, the company filed a lawsuit against Trey Styler, and he countersued for damages. The company ended up offering a settlement to Trey for around $136,000 for his efforts, but he rejected the deal, and a new series of legal issues took place between him and the company. During this, in 2008, while driving his Audi, he rear-ended a Volkswagen, and the woman in that car had medical bills in excess of $300,000. The case was settled in 2009. As Trey continued to fight with the company he believed owed him money, lawyers opposing him motioned to dismiss Trey's suit, and they did, and later he called someone in the company to tell them that he was thinking of killing himself. He then sued his attorney from the beginning, claiming that his attorney overcharged him and didn't do much of anything for him, and Trey won a judgment of $896,000, and the lawyer declared bankruptcy then. Trey Styler was never able to collect on any of this $896,000. He then went on to be diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disorder and sometimes was confined to a wheelchair. This all sort of occurring around 2008, which was right around the time of the recession. And with the bad investments, legal battles, and health issues, the Stylers saw the edge of destitution. In another interesting story, around this time, Trey Styler drove to meet with a colleague who was still working for the company that he battled with in court, and he drove all the way to Cheyenne, Wyoming, unannounced, to ring his doorbell and ask for help financially. This man claims that Trey had a messianic complex and the gift of being right. He said that when he got angry, he didn't back down and always wanted to be in control. Whatever eccentricities Trey had to begin with, a decade of problems and lawsuits had made them worse. A former colleague at one point said that Trey Styler was personally keeping their house under surveillance, and it forced his wife to file a police report against Trey. After vacating their large Greenwood Village home and going through a series of rentals, the Stylers set their sights on the money and glamour of Aspen, hoping to finally have a place to turn their luck around. Nancy Styler acquired an esthetician license for facials and Botox, and they used what remaining money they had to purchase an array of expensive spa equipment. They began their move to Aspen and had no idea that their problems were just beginning. At first, their meeting with Nancy Pfister seemed like the lucky break that they were needing. She was very well connected and immediately began introducing them to all the most elite and famous residents of Aspen. Nancy Styler began talking about opening up her own spa, which was a questionable plan given that she was destitute, and it was thought that Nancy Pfister had offered her money to open up a business, a prospect that, if it was proposed, would probably have only been talk. At one point, there was talk from Pfister about adding on a building to the home for Nancy Styler's new business, and the Stylers were overcome with joy at this point at all the talk and planning. They toasted to their new friendship and their new potential business relationship. They moved all their expensive equipment and belongings into Nancy Pfister's home, anticipating their winter renting without any issues. Nancy and Trey Styler rarely left each other's side at this time, and Nancy ran their relationship and made their decisions, including the one to move into Nancy Pfister's home, despite there being a lot of stairs in it and Trey largely being confined to a wheelchair. And here's where any of their happiness ended. Once the Stylers gave Pfister their initial down payment of $6,000, Nancy Styler claims that Pfister began treating her like a slave, telling her to grab her champagne, rub her neck, and rub her fingers. Pfister ended up throwing a going-away party for herself and asked the Stylers to purchase her cases of champagne and catering for the party in the amount of $1,600 from their already strapped funds, and they obliged, thinking that the money would come out of their rent. It wouldn't, and Pfister drank all of the champagne before the party was even held. This would only be the beginning of the misunderstandings between the Stylers and Nancy Pfister. Once Pfister had left for Australia, they thought the issues were over and they could focus on their business. but Pfister began a series of emails from Australia claiming that Nancy Styler had purchased clothing with her credit card and didn't pay her back, which they claimed they had. The hot water heater in the house broke, and the Stylers paid for the repair only after 4 weeks of no hot water in the home they were hoping to run a spa out of. In December of 2013, Pfister claimed that she was hiring a lawyer to dispute the charges for the clothing. Later that month, Pfister claimed again that they still owed her for the remaining $6,000 for the deposit plus the rent for December, and they had paid the amount to Kathy Carpenter and thought the issue was resolved, until they began receiving emails from Pfister demanding that they needed to leave and should move into a trailer down the road that was more suited for them. Trey was friends with Pfister on Facebook and saw many of her passive-aggressive statuses about him and his wife being lying bums and letting all of Aspen know what horrible people they were. It began to look like their business wasn't going to get the foothold in Aspen that they had planned on. David Olmsted, the private investigator who was hired for the case defending Nancy Styler, ended up saying that the claims against the Stylers for not paying their rent was not accurate. Olmsted had suggested that the money they paid Kathy Carpenter never reached Pfister's safe deposit box, and that Pfister had not been told by Kathy that they paid it. It was eventually revealed that no formal written agreement had ever been made between the Stylers and Pfister, something that the residents of Aspen were not shocked to hear, given Pfister's way of doing things. During the time that Pfister was away, the Stylers and Kathy Carpenter developed a bond, often getting together for bitch sessions. The relationship between Kathy Carpenter and Trey Styler was further deepened when she was having breathing issues at work one day, and Trey picked her up and gave her a shot of epinephrine, which Kathy believed saved her life. Pfister continued emailing other people in Aspen and letting them know about her issues with the Stylers, including her lawyer, Teresa Wyatt, the former friend who had watched Ellen with Kathy, the widow of Hunter S. Thompson named Anita, and Bob Broaddus, the former sheriff. Then, in the middle of February, Pfister decided that she was going to be coming home to deal with these issues despite her former plans to remain in Australia until May. The Stylers were seeing red, and Trey Styler went to the bank to try to get a loan in an amount between $25,000 and $50,000 to try to appease Pfister with money. The bank denied his loan. Pfister told them in an email that if they weren't out of her home by the time she returned, they would have to put her up in an expensive local hotel at their expense. But according to Kathy Carpenter and others, they mysteriously didn't start packing until the last minute. So at this point, I'm going to go through the basic timeline from when Pfister arrives back at Aspen, leading up to the discovery of her body on Wednesday, February 26th in the evening. Pfister flew into Aspen Saturday, February 22nd, 2014. Kathy later told detectives that Trey was eager to go pick her up, and when he was asked why by Kathy, he told her that Pfister needed to disappear forever, called her a horrible woman, and said that he never wanted to kill anyone more than he wanted to kill her. Kathy then exchanged her Subaru with the Stylers' car so that they could have a roomier car to move their stuff, and Kathy took the Stylers' Jaguar sedan to pick up Pfister after persuading Trey not to go. Kathy then spent Saturday evening with Pfister at her house and made a pact with her at that time that they would love each other as sisters since she didn't have any relationship with any of her sisters. Sunday morning, Kathy made Pfister breakfast and left the house for her Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with her sponsor, who later told police that Kathy seemed off and even looked different because Nancy Styler had given her a makeover and put false lashes on her. That Sunday, the Stylers went to the house to retrieve more items while Pfister was asleep and managed to move out items without waking her. At some point, Pfister awoke to send out text messages, one to her attorney to tell them that they left her house a wreck and that she wanted a restraining order taken out on them until she could get another $6,100 from them. After the AA meeting, Kathy met with Trey Styler so that they could change cars back, and Kathy began frantically looking for a piece of paper that she had lost in Trey's car. At this time, Kathy handed Trey an envelope, and on it was written demands from Pfister, asking them to now pay a total of $14,000 in back rent, utilities, snow plowing, and damages to her home. She wrote that she was holding the last of their expensive spa equipment left in her home hostage until she received the money. That night, Kathy slept at Pfister's home after running and getting groceries for her, and that same night, Trey was caught speeding in a nearby town at 12:15 a.m., which would now be the following Monday morning, And mysteriously, Trey could not find his proof of insurance or his car registration in his own car. The police officer did not ask Trey where he was going or what he was doing out that night. That Monday morning, Trey discovered that skiers had blocked in their moving truck with a car while the truck was parked near Pfister's property. Either Monday or Tuesday, the date was never officially determined, Kathy had a meeting with her psychotherapist near the Aspinall Lodge where the Stylers were staying, and near some evidence would later be found. On Tuesday, the Stylers called Pitkin County Sheriff's Office and asked for an escort to Pfister's home, and they agreed to have a sheriff parked nearby in case there were problems. When they arrived, they said the door was locked. The dog had a large bowl of untouched food inside, but there was dog feces all over the home due to Gabe not being let out. Pfister was nowhere to be seen. At this time, Nancy Styler called Kathy from the home and asked her if she thought Pfister had gone somewhere and killed herself. A male friend named Patrick Carney came over while they were there and said he went upstairs with Nancy Styler hot on his heels, but they didn't see Pfister in the bedroom. Nancy Styler would later say that he had gone up alone, and Kathy later told police that Nancy had called her earlier and told her that they had found Patrick alone in the home when they arrived. And Patrick had said that that was not the case and that he had just gone upstairs with Nancy there. The next day on Wednesday, Nancy Styler called Kathy again and said that Pfister was not at the house and there wasn't any sheets on the bed. She also said that her pills were still there, and that meant she probably didn't go off anywhere on a spontaneous holiday. At around noon, Patty Stranahan, a friend of the family, came into Alpine Bank where Kathy Carpenter was at work, and Kathy told her to make some calls around and look for Pfister because she was worried about where she was and she couldn't get a hold of her. Patty told Kathy that she was overreacting. At around 1 p.m. that same day, the Stylers left, and Nancy Styler later called Kathy again and told her that they might be back that night to pick up some bags of trash and a snowblower. Later that evening, at about 5:30 p.m., Kathy entered Pfister's bedroom looking for her and found the bed made, the prescriptions missing, the champagne still in the fridge that was not consumed, and she said that the house smelled odd. She then went upstairs to find the closet door locked, and the usual key from the closet that was normally in the lock was missing. She retrieved an extra key from her home and came back to discover the body of Pfister in the closet. And again, she told police when they arrived that she had seen the Stylers coming down from Pfister's house as she was arriving, a detail she left out when questioned later. At this point, the Stylers were on their way to Glenwood Springs to do an eyelash extension appointment for Nancy Styler. While Nancy Styler was in the appointment, a different woman from town called her to tell her that her boyfriend saw tons of police cars in front of Pfister's home, and Nancy told police later that she assumed Pfister had committed suicide. The following Thursday morning at 5:45 a.m., Pitkin County deputies went to the Aspinall Lodge and searched the Stylers' room and belongings. They then asked them to strip so that they could examine their bodies for any suspicious markings, and then brought them into the station for questioning. At around this time, CBI agents informed the sheriff's department that the underside of Pfister's mattress was bloodstained, meaning the mattress had been flipped. At that time, the officers were sure that more than one person had been involved in order to flip the mattress, and that Trey Styler could not have done it all alone in his frail state. The Stylers were taken to separate rooms and interrogated for 9 hours straight. Trey told police that they had just wanted to get out of there and away from Pfister and that they were not looking for any kind of revenge. Nancy's interview was much like Trey's, with no significant discrepancies. Trey was definitely more heavily questioned about his potential involvement in the murder, and he mentioned that in his condition, he didn't think he could beat up anyone. Trey was given a polygraph, which indicated deception, but he said that his medications might be throwing it off. Nancy Styler, for unexplained reasons, was never polygraphed, and Kathy Carpenter's polygraph also showed deception. The coroner indicated that Pfister had been dead 24 to 48 hours before Kathy Carpenter found her, placing her time of death between Monday evening and Tuesday evening before her body was discovered that Wednesday evening. Her toxicology report showed a common sleep aid and, to everyone's surprise, no alcohol or other drugs in her system. The Stylers were released from custody but told to stay close. Within 24 hours of Pfister's death, Kathy had gone to Pfister's safe deposit box and removed $6,000 in cash and some jewelry. The morning after her first interview, she returned for her second one, which lasted almost 12 hours. She told investigators that the Stylers had asked her a lot about Pfister's money and financial situation since Kathy had access to some information at the bank. She also told them, in what would be a pivotal statement in the case, that when she opened the door to the closet and found Pfister's body, she saw a strand of her blonde hair with blood on it. Investigators know from the initial viewing of the body that Pfister was completely wrapped in trash bags and covered with white sheets, and no hair or any part of her body was visible. Kathy could also describe the wounds on Nancy Pfister's head perfectly. Kathy was caught in a couple of other inconsistencies, the least of which was her claiming that she saw the Stylers and then claiming that she actually didn't see them, and also her son saying that she used the $6,000 in cash she took from the safe deposit box to pay for his plane ticket and a school fee, but she claimed that she didn't do that and took the jewelry and money with the intention of giving it to Juliana, Nancy Pfister's daughter. Detectives later would linger on the point that there was no chance she saw Nancy Pfister's bloody hair because she was in a sealed bag and covered with a sheet. She insists that she did see it, and this meant that she must have seen the body before it was wrapped in the trash bags and sheet. Kathy said nothing to refute this. Kathy was also at the center of money disputes between the Stylers and Pfister. She did not seem to register that her not telling Pfister that they had paid the remaining $6,000 was the catalyst of the entire winter dispute. Kathy Carpenter opened up more during these interviews about her relationship with Nancy Pfister, and she told investigators that Pfister once told her that she had possibly been molested by a family member. She alluded to a possible affair Pfister was having with a married man and Pfister's anger over her ever bringing it up to her. She also revealed more about the Stylers around the time of the murder, saying that Nancy Styler told her on Tuesday that Pfister's medicine bottles were still in her room, a detail that would later be called into question when it was too late. Kathy also told investigators that Nancy Styler had mentioned needing to get into the closet to put some stuff in, and she brought Nancy Styler the key, which was now gone, the extra key, that is, and the key would later be found on the ground in front of the Aspinall Lodge that had not been noticed before. During Kathy's questioning, more strange clues about the case began to emerge. A facilities manager found a black trash bag near the local Alpine Bank where Kathy worked and just behind the Aspinall Lodge. He went through the bag because it was not legal to dump local waste into that bin, and the bag was found in, and he wanted to find a clue inside of who dumped it so they could possibly be ticketed. The bag was found to contain a hammer with red flakes on it that would later be determined to be the murder weapon, prescription bottles for Nancy Pfister, a string of pearls, a United Airlines boarding pass for Pfister, numerous credit cards belonging to her, her health insurance card, her passport, and information related to some bank accounts for her. Curiously, the bag also contained the car registration and vehicle inspection for Trey Styler's Jaguar sedan and a receipt for Trey's post office box. The police then used this evidence to search Trey's car and used Luminol to find 9 separate small blood stains inside the car, and they discovered black trash bags of a similar kind to the one containing all the evidence. Tons of items belonging to Pfister were also found in Kathy's apartment, and inside a storage unit that Kathy rented, they found a small hammer, a light blue towel with a stain, a pillow with a red stain, and a left shoe with a red stain, and a hose with a red stain. Kathy was also soon arrested. And really, to be honest with this evidence, nothing more came of the items that were found in Kathy's storage unit. Police further confirmed that nearly $750,000 life insurance payout for Pfister's mother, Betty, had been deposited into Nancy Pfister's bank account back in November, and she had transferred $850,000 in total from her Alpine bank account to a Charles Schwab account. Additionally, in the Stylers' possessions, they found 3 laptops, 3 computers, a glass jar of marijuana, narcotics accessories, which really could mean many different things, and they found out that there was a gap in data service for Nancy Styler's phone between January 30th and February 24th, making it difficult to track her whereabouts during that time. They also found ketamine in Trey Styler's prescriptions, which in certain doses can render a person unconscious. And at one point, they questioned whether he was using this on himself or could have used it in the murder of Nancy Pfister, despite the fact that nothing was found in her toxicology report related to ketamine. During the interviews, private investigator David Olmsted flew in to meet with the Stylers at their hotel. He informed them that they would likely be arrested, and the following Monday, Brad Gibson finished putting together arrest warrants for Trey and Nancy Styler based on the evidence in the trash bag, the car evidence, and the ongoing problems between both the Stylers and Pfister, and they were arrested at that time. In the subsequent weeks, as information was shared with the sheriff's department and the rumor mill of Aspen went haywire, Bob Broaddus, the former sheriff, was accused of sharing too many intimate details of the case, which he shouldn't have known in the first place, with friends and family in Aspen and around the globe. Bob Broaddus seemed to have a constant line in on the investigation through the sheriff at the time, Joe DeSalvo. Right after Pfister's death, Bob Broaddus was the one to call her sisters and inform them before the sheriff's department, something that the family thought was ridiculous. David Olmsted ended up working exclusively for the defense team for Nancy Stylar and insisted that there was not a single shred of evidence linking her to the murder of Nancy Pfister, other than their ongoing dispute as an existing motive. One of Olmsted's biggest issues from the beginning was the leaking of information from Bob Broaddus to the entire town. His second issue was that he felt like Nancy Stylar was arrested solely because the police didn't think Trey was physically capable of committing the crime on his own. When talking with Nancy, it was revealed how much she hated Pfister. In a way, the two of them were very similar, but Nancy Stylar felt like she had earned whatever membership she had once had in the Colorado High Life, but Pfister had been born entitled. Nancy Stylar reiterated that she had never had anyone disrespect her in the way that Pfister had, and that there wasn't anyone in the town who had a nice thing to say about Pfister. Nancy Stylar then indicated that she couldn't rule out Suzanne Pfister, who until this point was almost forgotten about behind all these other suspects, despite the fact that she lived right up the road from Nancy Pfister. Nancy Pfister's sisters, Christina and Suzanne, always seemed to take a back seat to Nancy Pfister's wild antics. At the time of Nancy Pfister's murder, the three sisters were involved in a land right dispute, a detail which would largely be forgotten about but play a larger role in David Olmsted's theory about the case, going deeper than anyone had thought. In Christina's interview, she revealed that she had tried to get closer to Nancy after their mother died, but getting close with Nancy was impossible. Christina said that Nancy had borderline personality disorder and could twist up at any time. She also revealed that while her sister was in Australia, she was involved with a man that Christina didn't think was good for her. She criticized Kathy, who was originally supposed to be more of a sober companion for her sister, and was instead entangled into her drunken lifestyle. Even more revealing was that Christina said she was scared of Nancy when she was a child, and voluntarily enrolled herself in a boarding school at the age of 13 just to get away from her. Suzanne, on the other hand, was more upset, but it was largely because of the inconvenience placed on her and the fear she now lived in because her sister was murdered in her own home very near to where Suzanne's home was. So being wrapped up in Aspen life herself, the talk and rumor in the town and in the local papers was almost more than Suzanne could bear. At any rate, the sisters and Nancy Pfister's daughter, Juliana, seemed very preoccupied with the reputation of their family and the narrative around the memory of Nancy Pfister. David Olmsted, meanwhile, discovered what he believed to be another reason for Nancy Pfister's quick return from Australia other than the rental dispute over $6,000. He argued that there was little reason for her to return over this and that she had spent more money in changing flights and plans than the $6,000 was worth, especially given her recent inheritance. She could have hired anyone in Aspen to kick them out for less money than flying back. Others would later argue that this kind of ill-planned waste-of-money venture was exactly what she was known for. Olmsted discovered that a week before her return, on Valentine's Day, two new corporations were created in Aspen, one called Lazy Chair Lot 2 LLC and one called Lazy Chair Lot 3 LLC. Both are named after land owned by the late Betty and Art Pfister. The sale of the land was completed 2 days after Nancy Pfister's body was found in the closet, and the beneficiaries for the estate sale of $1.8 million were the grandchildren of Betty and Art Pfister, with none of the Pfister sisters benefiting from the sale. The total of the deals sealed on February 28th was $4.5 million, and Olmsted questioned whether or not Nancy Pfister had flown back to become involved in the sale of the estate. And given the approximation of these events to her sudden return and death, he wondered how much the transaction had to do with her death. So with all that at stake, Nancy Pfister flying back into town over the matter of $6,000 was looking less likely. And at this point, I'll say that the actual trial, or lack thereof, is going to be the most disappointing part of this case. To start, there's some bizarre arguing over the release of the arrest affidavits and evidence, which the media, as well as the rest of the public, was incredibly thirsty for. There were proposals to sever the preliminary hearings of all three defendants so that they would be tried completely separately, but the prosecution argued to keep the evidence together since they were all being charged not only with second-degree murder, but with conspiring to commit murder together. Then, in a shocking turn of events, the charges were completely dropped against Nancy Styler, and she was released with prejudice, meaning she could never be charged with the crime later. The reason for Nancy Styler's charges being dropped was revealed to be because Trey Styler had confessed to the murder, which he claimed he committed entirely alone. So now, with Trey Styler's confession and guilty plea, there would never be a trial in the case. There would never be a circus of court dates and media coverage descending upon Aspen for the months to come. There would not be any in-depth review of all the evidence, nor of the life and problems of Nancy Pfister, the town of Aspen, her family, the Stylers, or Kathy Carpenter. This was, in many ways, the most convenient outcome for the town. They needed someone in this case to be guilty, and the case against every defendant had room for reasonable doubt. They would never have to prove that anyone, including Trey, murdered Nancy Pfister. The family was understandably upset with the lack of any feeling of justice or explanation, but one can't help feel like the family would not have handled the revealing aspects that a trial would have most certainly brought to their lives. Trey Styler was sentenced to 20 years in a correctional facility that had access to medical care. The charges were then dropped on Kathy Carpenter, and she was released without prejudice, meaning her possible role would remain open indefinitely. With all this, Olmstead immediately noted that Trey's confession was accepted and moved through before all the evidence had even returned from the CBI, making it appear as if their desperation to find someone guilty far outweighed their interest in proving who killed Nancy Pfister using evidence, and proving guilt was also overshadowed by the Aspen judicial system, law enforcement, and social elite's interest in getting all this over with before the summer tour season was in full swing. In yet another bizarre move that no one anticipated would happen, Judge Nichols decided to release the entire case file minus important evidence surrounding Nancy Styler and Kathy Carpenter, who were now free and not found guilty of the crime. With this, we get to find out exactly what Trey said in his confession. Trey's reason for the confession appeared to be a bargain for the release of his wife, who he was assured would be released. His story contradicted everything said in the previous inquiries. Trey awoke on Monday morning, February 24th, and left his wife sleeping at the hotel to go look for a storage unit. He arrived before the storage unit was open for business, and with his mind reeling about the $14,000 Pfister now claimed they owed her, he made a decision to head to Pfister's house and tried to reason with her face to face. He said that, on top of his stress about the money, his wife Nancy had been in a state of deep anxiety and depression over the whole ordeal and was suicidal, and they were both completely at their wits' end. He wanted resolution. When he got to Pfister's house, he found a note in Kathy's handwriting on the door saying not to disturb because Pfister was sleeping. But he found the door unlocked and entered, calling out Pfister's name. He didn't get a response and went through part of the house, still calling her name, and was not getting any response. He then later found her asleep in her bed with an eye mask on, earplugs in, and likely still knocked out from her sleeping pills. While looking at her, he thought of their spa equipment that still was being held hostage and that they needed to start their lives fresh. He thought about the money. He thought about he and his wife's fall from grace and his anger over his previous legal battles and imagined what kind of legal battle he might be facing with Nancy Pfister. With these thoughts, he realized how easy it would be to end his problems right there. He went downstairs to the garage and retrieved a hammer from a toolbox, went upstairs, and first struck Nancy in the back of her head. He says in that instant, he regretted what he had just done, but didn't know if Pfister was still conscious. He repeatedly said that he didn't want her to suffer and struck her again in the forehead. His thought was, now what? Ah, shit, what the hell have I done? She was now bleeding, and his next thought was to contain the blood, and he went downstairs for plastic garbage bags. and he removed the sheets from the bed. Then realizing he couldn't fit her body into the garbage bags, he tied her body together in the fetal position with an electrical cord he found and then wrapped her in the garbage bag. Using the sheet, he dragged her body to the closet and locked it. He then summoned all his strength to flip the mattress. Then he decided to create a narrative that Pfister decided to just up and leave, as she was known to do, by removing her prescriptions, pearls, other items, and the hammer, and left. He and his wife then went about their daily plans, with her not knowing about the murder. At one point, she went inside a restaurant to speak with a friend, and he dumped the bag in the dumpster where they were, where it was eventually found. He had no explanation for the problems brought up with his wife's phone, which had working data right at this time, registering as if it was at Pfister's home that morning, and a call coming from it that morning from her home area. He suspected the phone might have been in his bag, and he just didn't know about it. In an earlier interview, he admitted to taking his wife's phone that morning so that it wouldn't go off and wake her up, and that he had made a call with it. For whatever reason, phone records were never actually pulled or looked at for the purposes of this case trial. Immediately, the motive for Trey protecting his wife was obvious, but him protecting Kathy had no obvious motive. In an earlier interview, he had told a detective to tell Kathy that he loved her, and they suspected that her believing that he had saved her life had strengthened their friendship. He didn't have much to say about any of it. Investigators also brought up how odd it was that he was so easily able to go up and down the stairs in Nancy Pfister's home that day to get the hammer, and then again for the garbage bags, and then again for the cord. Trey Styler reasoned that his neurodegenerative disorder came and went, and that he was so high on adrenaline that he suppressed any pain. For the entire length of his court appearances, he was brought in a wheelchair. Again, it was questioned whether or not one person, let alone a supposedly frail one, could flip the mattress. And again, Trey said that he somehow summoned the strength. Investigators also questioned how the key to the closet ended up on the ground feet from his door in their hotel room. He said he didn't know. And with that, we heard all we would hear from Trey Styler. On August 6, 2015, Trey Styler hung himself with a sheet in his cell in Canyon City, Colorado, and questions only remain about what actually happened. Trey's confession didn't provide any answers, only more questions. To reiterate, on Monday morning, after killing Pfister, he said that he removed the pills that his wife said were there the following day. He also said that he killed Nancy Pfister a full 12 hours before the coroner said she could have died, and before she herself sent emails to Bob Broaddus at 3:30 in the afternoon, asking if he wanted to come to a party the next day. Nancy Pfister herself sent an email 6 hours after Trey Styler said he had killed her. The investigators did not follow up on any of these inconsistencies. Nancy Pfister's friend, Teresa, who before had dodged her at a farmer's market and watched her meltdown while watching Ellen, said, quote, "Nancy Pfister wasn't perfect. I'm the first to admit that. She was bossy. She said, go do this. And under my breath, I'd say, yes, master. But I saw it all as entertainment. Nancy was a magnet, a force, the life of the party. Aspen doesn't feel the same. The farmer's market is different now. When you met her, you never knew what game she was going to play. And the game is over. You don't go downtown and see her anymore. The magic is gone." Nancy Styler, who now goes by Nancy Masson, did a series of interviews after the murder, and she claimed again that she had no involvement, and if she had, she would have done a better job. She claimed that she was only guilty by matrimony, and that is the name of a book that she later released in 2015. In the book, Nancy Styler opens up more about her previously glamorous and comfortable life in Denver, and her hatred of Pfister, and the significance that their quarreling had in the final straw to the downward spiral of her entire life. However, she insists that she knew nothing about the murder of Nancy Pfister, and after pulling her own phone records, asserts that she can prove that she was not there that day. To me, it seems like Nancy Styler mourns the loss of her reputation more than anything else. On top of any money that Nancy Styler could potentially collect from the book sale, she was set to collect a $1 million life insurance policy after Trey's death, despite him having committed suicide. Juliana Pfister filed a wrongful death suit against Nancy Styler, and after hearing about the possible insurance payout and the book, she thought she was trying to profit from the death of her mother. The suit also brings up the lingering issue that Trey Styler did not act alone when he killed Pfister. However, in July of 2015, Nancy Styler filed for bankruptcy, and as of 2016, she was only able to collect $150,000 of the payout, which was paid immediately to the bankruptcy estate. The remaining $850,000 went to Juliana Pfister. So, in reflection of this case, what happened? Personally, I feel like all three people, Kathy and the Stylers, were somehow involved in this and could have conspired to do it while Nancy was asleep so that there would be no struggle. Why did Trey decide to confess? Trey had already admitted to being suicidal. He was getting old, he was frail, and he was often in pain from his disease. I believe he wanted nothing more than to make his wife happy and to make sure that she was free. It's possible that he reflected on his life and realized that a lot of their problems were his problems. Some out of his control, like his injury, but some related to his relentless ego and desire to win. He wanted this to be over for everyone, but mostly he wanted it to be over for his wife. Questions still remain about just how disabled he was and whether or not he was playing up his disability after he was arrested, since many people saw him walking around before that time. Questions still remain about his relationship with Kathy and what on earth went on between Kathy, Nancy Styler, and Trey while Pfister was away. I think that the garbage containing the evidence was way too convenient. When I first read about it, it seemed like such an obvious plant for a frame job. What was Trey's registration doing in the bag with not only the murder weapon, but Nancy's pearls and prescription bottles? Was Trey Styler stupid enough to just dump these things right into a trash can by his hotel? Trey had not found his registration in his car that morning at 12:15 a.m. when he was pulled over for a speeding ticket, and Kathy Carpenter had been driving his car around when they switched cars. Why on earth would his car registration be in the same bag with all those items? Were they somehow in Pfister's home and he just absentmindedly grabbed them while he was trying to set the narrative? But why were they in her home to begin with? Why was Kathy's story so vague? Why did she insist that she saw bloody hair on Pfister when her body was wrapped up? I think she saw the hair before the body was wrapped up and was mixing up these memories. She had a tendency to be very vague and strange in her wording, and in listening to the 911 call, she seems hysterical, but to me it feels a little bit over the top. Was there a possibility at all that other people other than those three were somehow involved in this? Bob Broaddus, Pfister's lawyer, local friends, were all copied in the emails that she sent out complaining about the Stylers. They all knew about the issues that were brewing. Nancy Pfister could have been the life of the party, but she also made a lot of enemies in her life. There was no attempt whatsoever to examine any other possibilities in this case, and yes, I agree, the Stylers and Kathy are immediately the most obvious suspects, but there was a lot going on in Nancy Pfister's life at the time, and it was never addressed. What about her sisters, particularly Suzanne? Was this a convenient opportunity for everyone's issues to be over with, and the land deal coming up, and the arguments over the land deal to be completely over? This case and the handling of it is reminiscent of the famous bungled investigation of the death of JonBenet Ramsey, and like that case, it's a disheartening glimpse at how the law is enforced when the wealthy and elite of the country are involved, or when the wealthy and elite of the communities of the country are at risk of being inconvenienced. And, you know, I could say that if I saw Nancy Pfister coming down the street in my direction, I would probably turn and run the opposite way for fear of getting sued over looking at her the wrong way. But that doesn't mean that she deserved to be murdered. So, in a final note, I'll quote Hunter S. Thompson, who lived in Aspen and actually ran for sheriff during the weirder years, parted with Nancy Pfister and committed suicide there on February 20th, 2005. Life should not be a journey to the grave with the intention of arriving safely in a pretty and well-preserved body, but rather to skid in broadside in a cloud of smoke, thoroughly used up, totally worn out, and loudly proclaiming, "Wow." Thank you, everyone. I hope you enjoyed it. If you enjoy my podcast, please go on iTunes and subscribe and rate and drop me a line on the Facebook page. That would be awesome. I'm enjoying hearing some different suggestions for cases to do. And of course, I'm always open to your ideas or your corrections or your thoughts on any case that I cover. So thanks, everybody.